many people only know of the region from the number of wars that have been and continue to be fought there. What are they missing? What are Afghanis like?
When people ask me about Afghanistan, what word that comes to my mind first, before any other, is warmth. The Afghanistan that I knew in the 1970s was a place where schoolgirls, dressed like Catholic schoolgirls in the U.S., short skirts, long socks, a small scarf on their over their heads, and laughed in the streets. There were outdoor cafes. There were movie theaters. There were long camel caravans that came silently through the streets in the afternoon sun. People welcomed us everywhere. There was no sense of fear whatsoever. It was called by travelers Paris of the East at that time. During the hippie era, there were 5,000 hippies living in Kabul. You could hear, and for some of the older listeners, you could hear, I remember one time in particular, I could hear the Rolling Stones mixed with the evening sound of the evening call to prayer. It was, to my brother and me, the Wild West in the East. But more than anything else, what drew me there was how warm people were, how welcoming they were. And for us, of course, Westerners, we could get on a plane and leave with a passport, extremely poor, but it was so, there was a sense of romance, a sense of, Kabul was a small town to me. It was about 250,000, 300,000 today, 4 million. So innocent, so warm, so welcoming, so unwarlike.
And what were some of your first assignments there?
My first assignment was in 1981, and I went back as a New York Times and had a met with the New York Times bureau chief in for all of South Asia. They had one at the time. He was based in India, and he came over from Pakistan, Mike Kaufman, who became my mentor in so many ways. And he, I remember so clearly that he took me up into the mountains one day. And he was married and had children, and he was not going to go into this war zone. And this is what I wanted to do, and this is why they I made this arrangement with them to go. And he took me up into the mountains, and I was nervous. And we looked over through the forest, the mountains, toward Afghanistan, and he said, "Don't worry about the story. It will come to you." And there was a sense, it gave me a sense of comfort. This will not be so bad. I don't have to worry so much. And I met up with various Mujahideen groups, Mujahideen meaning holy warriors. These were the groups backed by Pakistan and the CIA that were fighting the Soviet Union. It was the war against the Afghans. The Mujahideen became a proxy army for the West, particularly the United States. It's made very clear in the movie Charlie Wilson's War. It came out just a few years ago. And I went in and lived with the Mujahideen. And I lived in the mountains with a man who, his name is Haqqani, became a very close ally of the United States, worked very closely with the CIA, and who became, and who is today, the most lethal, the most effective, the most powerful Taliban leader. He treated me like a king. They always treated me so well. They saved my life three times. So in the mountains in Pakistan, and then in the desert down in Afghanistan, I lived with the Mujahideen and came back. It was my first assignment, first article I ever wrote for the Times, and they put it on the front page, and then the next one too. And that was my introduction to the world of Afghanistan as a journalist, living with the Mujahideen in the mountains along the Afghan-Pakistani border, and then in the desert in the south in Kandahar.
Now, you used both terms there in this recounting, Mujahideen and then Taliban. When did the Taliban emerge in Afghanistan?
Fascinating point. The Taliban are an integral part of Afghan culture. They are the lowest people on the totem pole. Traditionally, they would live in the village, but they would spend all their time in the mosque. They're the ones who called people to prayer. They're the ones who would preside over births and over deaths. They never had any power in the tribal structure. The Mujahideen, made up primarily of rural people, but in the latter years, during the 80s, became increasingly comprising most of the Afghan population that chose not to flee as refugees to Pakistan or to Europe or to the United States. The Taliban came out of, eventually formed themselves using the leadership, some of the leadership of the Mujahideen and new recruits. The Mujahideen means holy warrior. A Talib is a student. It can also be translated in Persian as a seeker. The Taliban is the plural of Talib. So they were religious students. They came out of the civil war that erupted after the Soviet Union left, and the Mujahideen began to fight amongst themselves. And the Taliban started with a man named Mullah Omar, who was a former member of the Mujahideen, who wanted to cleanse the country of the civil war, of this unrighteousness, as they put it, and to establish finally, in their eyes and in their minds, a pure Islamic government. Pakistan began to take it over. Saudi Arabia got involved. And then through Saudi Arabia and others, then Al-Qaeda came into the picture, and the Taliban took over the country. And we all know what happened ultimately after that, because that led to 9/11.
Do you have a sense that, similar to when the Soviets left, that when the American troops pull out of Afghanistan, will that lead to another civil war?
Yes. There's no doubt in my mind whatsoever that the Afghans ultimately are going to have to sort this out, and we are going to see some form of civil war. It depends. We don't know exactly what the United States is going to do. I'm not sure the government knows itself what ultimately it's going to do, if it's going to leave 50,000 soldiers there or troops, or how many will stay there. But if all foreign forces were to leave, there would be a bloodbath. There will be civil war. I remember traveling with two tribal chiefs, also members of parliament, down along an area called Khost, down along the Afghan-Pakistani border. This was in, it's been 4 years now, it was 2007. And we were stuck in the on a road behind a U.S. convoy. And the two, these are members of parliament, tribal chiefs, in a sense, as part of this, the establishment of Afghanistan, working with the U.S., and they were very frustrated, and there was a sense of humiliation because the U.S. convoy was in the center of the road, it was going slowly, we had to sit on the side and wait, and the soldiers or the Americans were telling everybody to get out of the way, and I could feel it in them. And they said it, this humiliation. And then this one tribal chief said to me, "But if they left, they being the Americans, the Taliban would take over in a week." And then he said, "No, they would take over in a day."
In your book, Captive, you detail your imprisonment by the Taliban. You had gotten to know a number of the tribal chiefs, as you've just been talking about, also soldiers, their families. They even protected you at times. What changed?
What changed was what I was doing, relying upon the network, the Mujahideen network, of which I was a part as a visitor, as a journalist in the 1980s, I went back to Afghanistan and wanted to, using that same network, and some of these men are today members of parliament, and others are up in the mountains fighting against the Americans. It's as if you went to, in the U.S., you go to a grade school, you played sports together, or you went to church together, or a debate club together, whatever it may be. When you get older, you still maintain those friendships. So it is in Afghanistan today, between those who are on the side of the U.S. and those who are up in the mountains. I went to members of parliament, established what I was trying to do, and the book that I had written in the 1980s, the text of which meant nothing. The pictures meant everything. See, I was here with you before. I understand you. I was here when your backs were against the wall. I'm not like these other journalists here. I want to go and find the Taliban leaders today who were Mujahideen leaders before, because I felt, based upon a number of factors, that if I could find out what the American government doesn't seem to have found out yet, that I could find out, because of some of the, and one Arab in particular who was with us many years ago, maybe I could find out a little bit about Al-Qaeda. I could go into this area where no reporter had gone in 20 years, and just maybe, trying on my experiences, understanding the culture, understanding the language to a degree, knowing how to dress, how to eat, how to act, how to pass as an Afghan, maybe, just maybe, I could find out what the U.S. government has thus far been able to find out about Al-Qaeda. What happened was, and this goes back to a poem by Rudyard Kipling, the poet laureate, if you will, the British Raj, "Here lies a fool who tried to hustle the East. I became too anxious to meet a book deadline. I was too trying to move, quit acting like an Afghan and more like an American. I began to move too quickly. I didn't see what was going on all around me. I didn't realize until it was too late that people around me, and I still don't have all the answers, were setting me up, and I was betrayed and captured, kidnapped in the mountains of Pakistan.
You placed yourself in extreme danger, which that's part of your job, getting the story. Is it ever not worth it to get a story when your life is in extreme or constant danger?
I didn't think that what I was doing, I knew it was dangerous, but I didn't think that I would be harmed, because I understood the ancient tribal code of the Pashtuns, the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan and across the border in Pakistan. The Taliban are Pashtuns. One of the most important tenets of this ancient tribal law called Pashtunwali, which means way of the Pashtuns or Pashtunism, is to protect to the death a guest. They protected me and saved my life three times in the 1980s. I had gone with them at different times now as a reporter for CBS since 2001. I went with the Taliban each separate times, four times. They always kept their word. They always protected me. I remember so clearly that when we were ready to cross, the final time to go deep into the tribal areas, we got near the border. A driver who had taken me into very dangerous areas was sitting by his car, and my interpreter said, "Give him gas money." That's right. I hadn't paid him money for 3 days for driving me in different places. So I took out a 1,000-rupee note, Pakistani money, which is worth more than Afghan money along the border. It's worth about $20. I went up to him, and I gave him the money. And his eyes were watery. And he came up to me, and he hugged me. And then he said something I didn't quite understand. And then he did what no Afghan has done in the 30 years, over the 30-year period of my experience in Afghanistan, is he kissed me on the cheek. And then he said, "Hodip Aman, go with God." And right then, I knew what I was about to do was extremely dangerous. And to this day, I don't know if that was a Judas kiss or not.
How were you treated when you were imprisoned by the Taliban?
I was treated on, there were times when I was certain that I would be killed within seconds. No question, 100% certain. There were times when I would spend days lying in my cot trying to decide whether I would rather be beheaded or shot through the head or with a, raked with bullets across my chest. I was frightened to death that they would sell my kidneys. My interpreter quit translating for me. One of my bodyguards was flipped and turned against me. We fought over, or we would argue over, or turf warfare, or territorial disputes. It became primal in so many ways. On the other hand, they never touched me. They never laid a hand on me. They fed us. They always said, "We will protect you if other Taliban try to come here or try to kill you or to take you and sell you." It was always this fear. It was tribal law. Pashtunwali, you are our guest. We must protect you. And people would say when I would talk like this, "This is crazy." But I would also say, "Maybe I'm alive today because they protected me. They never harmed me. They treated me with respect. They gave me a pen. They gave me paper. They gave me a sweater. They gave me my reading glasses." I remember in that prison how ashamed I was that I had failed. I was going to go into the heart of the Taliban to try and describe them to America, as I had described the Mujahideen before. I thought maybe I could find out about Al-Qaeda, and I had failed. I was a prisoner. The chances of my surviving were very slim. And I knew, because there was a predator above us, that the United States was either trying to kill the people who had me, or that predator was up there, meaning the U.S. government was involved, to try and find a way to get me out. And I realized that just as that my mentor said to me so many years ago when I was looking across the border, "Don't worry about the story, it will come to you I realized that when I was in that prison, that the story of the Taliban had come to me, and it was my job to take good notes, to stay alive, and to write a book about the Taliban.
And then one day, the Taliban just let you go free. How did that happen?
I remember it so clearly that the Taliban commander came in, and he sat down right across from me, and his eyes were like cat's eyes, and he was smart, and he was quick, and he was frightening, and he was also extremely straight with me. He said, "Congratulations on escaping death." I said, "What are you talking about? You're going to be released today." And I couldn't, and then he kept saying again, "Congratulations on escaping death." And I said, "Well, to myself, you promised that you wouldn't kill me at different times. Somebody above you, somebody made a decision not to kill me. Who, how, what, where?" They blindfolded me again. They put a woman's, what's called a burqa in the West, the word there, shadari, over me, and they put me in a car, and they took me, and they drove me for a few hours, who knows where and how, and then they let me out, and for the first time in almost 2 months, I was able to see the sky, and I couldn't see very well, and then we hiked out, and I remember passing through a village and people staring at us. We were the Taliban. You couldn't tell the difference by the way I looked, and everybody armed with me except me and my body, one of my interpreters, or my interpreter and bodyguard, passed from one Taliban group to the next, across mountains, across rivers. It wasn't until I came back and into Afghanistan, into a U.S. military base, and then did various debriefings, and the FBI took over, and the FBI is in charge of all kidnappings of Americans around the world, and then from then, a plane up to the embassy, and FBI brought me back to New York. And over time, I began very slowly to piece it together, and I heard that the former Mujahideen leader, the member of parliament who had arranged for me to see this particular Taliban leader, had called the Taliban leader to his house when I was in prison and said, "Release Jerry and do not harm him." I've heard that this one particular UN person was involved in getting me out. I heard that Haqqani himself, the man I was trying to get to, was informed of my presence and said, and maybe he helped release me. I've heard that there was a ransom. I was $1.5 million plus three men from Guantanamo. I know for certain that the three men from Guantanamo were never released because I gave the names to the FBI and they verified that. To this day, no one will tell me exactly how I got out. I asked the FBI, "What about that predator, that drone that was overhead 18, 20 hours a day for a month at least on end? Was that for me, or was that to kill the Taliban?" And all he would say was, "The U.S. government, we brought all assets into play." Today, I still don't know why or how. I was allowed to live. I was the next foreign journalist kidnapped in Pakistan after Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was slaughtered by Al-Qaeda in Karachi in 2002. Almost 6 years to the day, I was next. What I was told was a great many people did all that they could to prevent a second Daniel Pearl. I still don't know why, or I still don't know how or what everyone did.
Well, we're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Will you be returning to Afghanistan?
I don't know. I'm told I should never go back, that I'm a marked man. I've received about 50 phone calls from Pakistan since I've been released. It's not just me. It's my brother, for example, received a phone call, and therefore his wife, my sister-in-law, would be worried about her children. There's so many things. It's not just me. This is much, much bigger than myself. If I were ever to go back, I would never tell anybody.
Today you're giving the Rule Lecture at the U of O, your alma mater. Many journalism students will be in attendance. What will be your message to them?
My message will be that there is no blueprint for success, that you have to follow your own beliefs, your own wishes, your own desires, and that while I took journalism classes, I took a number of other classes, and there were many twists and turns that led me into the world of Afghanistan, and that I feel an enormous responsibility, because I was saved and because I'm alive, to pass on all that I learned and I have learned as a journalist over the years, and that most of all, to listen to their instincts, listen to themselves, and to know that until I was kidnapped, I never wanted to be anywhere else in the world but along that border. And even today, I still don't hate, and I can't hate. I can't allow myself that. Anybody there, and particularly the men who kidnapped me.
Jerry, thank you so much for your time and your stories today. And I'm glad you got home safely.
Thanks so much.